All right. Well, first of all, you might notice I sound a little bit different today. I'm sick right now. I've got a flu or a cold or something. And, you know, I gotta say, it's a lot nicer to, so much nicer to be able to just be in my closet and do a lecture, when I'm sick, than have to, go into the university and you know, actually lecture on things and stand up and all that. Though I do have to do it tomorrow, so that's kind of a bummer. But it is nice to be able to stay home in the closet one day of the week. So, all right. Your exam is due soon. Some people have taken it, some people haven't. If you're comparing your current score to the score that's already up for the last exam, don't worry yet, because I haven't done any curving or anything, and I don't know. So far, it looks like there will be somewhat of a curve, not as much as last time, which is great, but there will be some. So like I say, don't worry yet. Things can change, and so once all of the exams come in, then I'll apply the actual curve. So then, hopefully, you won't have a reason to worry. But if you do, then that's when you can worry. All right, another thing. I was thinking about your breaking cultural norms homework that I assigned in the last lecture. And it should be due a week from when this lecture is posted. But actually, with Thanksgiving coming up, that is the perfect time for you to be able to break some of these conversational norms. So I'm going to let it go past Thanksgiving, and you can do it. That'll, you know, it'll give you the chance to do it with your family, or, you know, friends or whoever you're hanging out with, if you're doing a Friendsgiving or whatever. So we'll make it due not the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, but actually the Monday after Thanksgiving. So it'll give you more of a chance to actually do the experiment. The guidelines and the posting area should be up today, where whenever you're listening to this, it'll be up for you. So you can either take a look at the guidelines if you forgot from the last lecture, which is fine. Take a look at that. Take a look at the requirements, like what I want you to post. Then if you've done it already, you can go ahead and post it. And if you want to do it later this week or over Thanksgiving, you can do it and then post it then. All right. So let's jump into our chapters for this week. The first thing I want to do, you might have noticed that on last week's schedule, I had something I wanted to talk about that I forgot about, which was both unplanned, but also kind of planned, which was that, the word that in writing. I wanted to talk about the use of that, or the overuse or underuse of that in, like, fiction writing. It would have fit perfectly with last week's topic, but it also actually fits perfectly with this week's topic, because we're still kind of in the realm of those garden path sentences. This week, you'll see that what we're doing is moving between sentences and, like, paragraphs, larger, some structure larger than a sentence. It's kind of a fun topic for me because I don't think I talked about this in the first lecture where I kind of introduced myself, but I'm a writer not just of research. I also write research papers, but of, like, fiction, right? So I've got a few things published. I'm in a, you know, couple books. I've written for a couple podcasts and things like that. So writing is really actually my first love before psychology and linguistics and things like that. So, but they actually go together really well. Actually, this is kind of an interesting story. the first thing I ever wanted to do in college was write movies. And so I went to the counselor and I told him that I wanted to do that. And they're like, oh, go to journalism. And I'm like, okay, I guess that seems acceptable. ASU didn't have a film program at that time, so they just kind of funneled us all through journalism. And when they did get a film program, most people in journalism who wanted to do movies moved over to the film program. But by that time, I'd totally gotten sick of the entire idea, so I changed my major to English literature, and I stuck with that for a while. And then I added psych on as a minor, and then I was dual majoring in psychology and English literature, which is a totally weird thing to dual major in. And then my English professor said, like, well, I was applying for a PhD program in English literature. And he said, why would you do that? Like, what is your goal? And I said, I want to write books, man. That's like the fun thing. And he said, well, don't, if you get a PhD in English literature, you're not going to be writing books. You're going to be teaching classes on how to write. So if you want to publish books, go do something else and write books. You know, because you can, like, you're good enough to do it, so just go do it. So I thought I was following his advice. I stuck with the psychology other major that I had, graduated from that, got a PhD in psychology, did all this research in perception, and now I'm teaching linguistics, psycholinguistics. Like, some, there's a point when perception and memory research and all that leaks over back into language, and now I'm doing writing again. So it's kind of this weird circular pathway that's gotten me back to writing. So anyway, this is kind of it's a very cool field to be in, to now think about writing from two different perspectives, thinking about it as a writer, but also thinking about it as someone who studies human behavior, and seeing that sometimes writers don't actually know what they're talking about, even though they do it for a living. And then also noticing that sometimes the people that are studying human behavior aren't taking into account everything that happens during the writing or reading process. One of those we'll talk about in a second, which is the word that, the thing that I left out last time that I really want to talk about this time. Anyway, I won't get ahead of myself. I'll wait till we get there. All right. So, syntax. Again, we've talked about syntax a lot, right? We've talked about it from the beginning of this class, and it's still showing up, right? Syntactical structure. So we left off in the Warren book, and he was saying, like, look, it looks like syntax is really what's governing the way that we process these sentences, especially garden path sentences. And so there you go. And then he picks up in chapter 11 and says, this is what people think. People who really study syntax think that it is a syntax-heavy process. So the where the words go in the sentence, the type of word that's going to go into that sentence, is dictating to us what that sentence is going to mean. But then he says, well, that might not be true. One of the reasons why this might not be true is plausibility. Like, plausibility will come in and change around what the sentence could mean. It'll make you think a little bit more about what you're reading and not take it so seriously. So our old standby sentence of colorless green ideas sleep furiously is syntactically okay, grammatically okay, but it's not a super plausible sentence. Right? It's a little weird. And so if there is an alternative explanation to it, that meaning will come up. Now, for colorless green ideas sleep furiously, there's not really an alternative explanation for it. I mean, I gave you my, like, real deep interpretation of it, but there's nothing that stands out as a, it's not a garden path sentence, is what I'm trying to say. It's not leading you off in a direction and then, oh, that's not actually what's happened. It's just a completely implausible sentence. In the book, Warren talks about they had a picnic under the trees or they had a picnic under the teeth. And they had a picnic under the teeth. It takes longer to process than they had a picnic under the trees. And that's an effect of plausibility. So syntactically, it's fine. Just like colorless green ideas sleep furiously. But if you had never heard of colorless green ideas sleep furiously, because now that makes sense to you. It has a plausible meaning because you know that it means that you can have a sentence that's grammatically correct, but semantically meaningless. Like, that's its meaning. That's what it does. But they had a picnic under the teeth has no meaning to you, presumably. I mean, the closest thing I can come up with is like some hellish nightmare landscape where all the trees grow, the tree trunks are tongues, and then the leaves are teeth, and sometimes the, you know, in the fall, the teeth fall off, and you can step on one, and it'd be like stepping on a Lego, and, you know, all hell would break loose. So it doesn't have a good meaning. The plausibility of it, or I guess I should say the implausibility of it, makes it harder for us to understand that we've read the right thing. We say teeth, they had a picnic under the teeth. What does that mean? And then you go back over it and try to figure out what you just read. But a picnic under the trees doesn't need any further processing. It comes in and that's processed well. Another side to that coin comes into play when you think about one of our Garden Path sentences, the horse raced past the barn, fell. So I don't know if we talked about that one in the lecture. I think I try to steer clear of that one because it's used in the book so much. But if you recall that what is actually being meant by that sentence is there is a horse, or I guess there's a group of horses perhaps, and the one that was raced past the barn, so someone was on it and they were racing it past the barn, fell down. But of course, we are garden pathed by the sentence to think that it is the horse raced past the barn, period, is what we're expecting, like the horse raced past the barn. And then we see the word fell, and that's interesting. So then we're garden pathed, and we have to go back and try to figure out an alternative explanation to it. So the plausibility argument comes in here to say that it's not a horse. It's not just a horse that's out there. We can understand a horse. When it's the horse, we assume that there are multiple horses. And when we have to assume that there's multiple horses, then that adds in an entire different processing component. There's layers to the sentence that we're not aware of before we jump into it. So this sentence is kind of a loaded sentence. It implies that there are multiple horses. And we're not expecting that. We're kind of just expecting the horse raced past the barn. There is one horse. He races past the barn. But when we have to specify the horse raced past the barn, as in the horse that was raced past the barn, that implies that there are multiple horses, which we're not aware of. There's some other layer here. How many horses are there? We don't know, but there's definitely more than one, because now we have to make a distinction between the other horses and the one that was raced past the barn. That's the one that fell. Because the argument would go that if you didn't need to distinguish which horse it was, you could just say the horse fell or a horse fell. We don't need to know that it was raced past the barn, if there's one. But if there's multiple horses, we need to know that it was the one that was raced past the barn that fell. And so that comes into play with our garden path sentence. We will try to take the easier and therefore more plausible explanation. Without other information saying that there are tons of horses, then we don't know, it's implausible to us, that it's not just going to be the horse raced past the barn, you know, sans other horses. That sentence would be fine on its own. It's more implausible that there's this background knowledge that we're not privy to when the sentence starts. So that's one alternative to just a purely syntactic method of processing. Now here's where I want to take my detour. And the detour that I want to take is for that. So when he's talking about the sentence, the horse race past the barn fell, he points out again that you can use pauses, like commas, the horse raced past the barn, fell. Or you can actually use the phrase that, complementizers like that. The horse that was raced past the barn fell. And so there's this kind of implicit argument that using that helps disambiguate sentences. It's an implied argument, but it's not an untrue argument in any way. It's absolutely true. I mean, there's another one. Fat people eat accumulates. That's totally crazy the first time you hear it, right? But it actually means fat that people eat accumulates. I assume the more pork you eat, then the fat from that pork will accumulate on your body instead of the pork that you've been eating. I say this because there's a cool store. So if you're local, if you're one of the people that are local to Arizona, and there's like two of you that are out here by me, I know this. So there's a place called The Pork Shop out on Combs and Gansel, I think. The best pork that you're going to find, like, probably in Arizona, although there are a couple places in Phoenix that have really good pork products as well, salamis and things like that. Anyway, so Google it. The Pork Shop is what it's called. They've got these pork sticks. They're totally amazing. They've got like something called Russian salami. So if you like large peppercorns and caraway seeds in your salami, this is totally the salami for you. It's got tons of this stuff in there. Anyway, pork has been on my mind because of this. It's really good stuff. You should check it out. And apologies if you are a vegan. You can just retroactively skip through that part, I guess. Anyway, so fat people eat accumulates is grammatically fine, but it's confusing, and it's less confusing if we add in the word that. Fat that people eat accumulates. I've been racking my brain to try to come up with my own unique garden path sentence, and finally this week I did. I hear Jimmy throwing, the fight was unexpected. It's not the greatest, but you start down your garden path of, I hear Jimmy throwing. What is he throwing? Up is he throwing, you know, a basketball against the garage door, something like that, right? And then you understand that it's a different meaning of hear and throwing. So Jimmy throwing, the fight was unexpected. And just like our other garden path sentences, if you add the word that, I hear that Jimmy throwing the fight was unexpected, totally changes your garden path experience. No longer are you garden pathed by the sentence. So that is an important word for disambiguation. In writing, in creative writing, but also just in writing in general, like one of the ways that we're taught to enhance the flow of our writing and the readability of what we write is to delete the word that. One of the things that you might say is, we understood that this was not allowed. And the argument would go that, yeah, okay, that's a fine sentence. It's well formed. We understood that that was not allowed. We understood that tardiness was not allowed is a better one, because then you're not using that twice in a row. So let's say we understood that tardiness was not allowed. It's a fine sentence. You can cut out that, though. We understood tardiness was not allowed, and it's also fine. The complementizer in this case, is unnecessary. And by using less words, the fewer words you can use, the better in terms of readability. Then the better the sentence, right? So, we understood tardiness was not allowed is preferable to we understood that tardiness was not allowed. At least in writing when we're worried about flow. But maybe when we're worried about disambiguation, that might not be the case. That example that I'm using, though, there's nothing to be confused, right? So there's no garden path sentence going on. I think the tip is a good one, usually. So if you're a writer, or if you want to be a writer, I think that is a good rule of thumb to follow, is that when the sentence doesn't need the word that, and it's fine, and there's nothing ambiguous there, you can go ahead and drop it. You might be familiar with Ernest Hemingway, right? He's a great writer. One of the reasons that he was such a great writer was that he used really short, punchy sentences. I don't know if you're familiar with the writer H.P. Lovecraft. He writes horror novels, he writes horror stories. I don't know if he writes novels. He writes exceedingly long sentences. The stories are good, but it takes you a long time to fall into the story. It takes a long time for me to fall into the story. Once I'm in, he does a really good job of crafting a... That's funny, it's part of his name. He does a pretty good job of crafting, you know, horror and weirdness. But I can't really say that any time I've ever started one of the stories, I would have stuck with it if someone hadn't told me that this was someone I should read. It's a long, drawn-out, breathy sentence that just goes on forever. And it uses needlessly large words. You know, it kind of sounds like he just sat around with a thesaurus and, like, pulled words out. He's like, well, we could say scary, but also we could say something that's 80 letters long. Ernest Hemingway is exactly the opposite. And I remember being assigned to read Ernest Hemingway in high school, possibly, or maybe one of my college classes. I didn't think that I was going to like it. I mean, you know, you just kind of assume that, like, these classic pieces of literature, they're going to be boring or whatever. And something about that writing style, it's easy to just get drawn in by the fact that he rarely has a sentence that goes more than one line, right? So it's just easy. It's easy to read. It's like makes itself be a page turner just based on the fact that it's quick. And then he's, you know, pretty good at crafting a good story as well. So I would say, at least in this anecdotal, in my anecdotal evidence, that shorter sentences are preferred. Yeah, you need a long one every once in a while. Certainly in some technical writing, you need a longer sentence every once in a while. And I guess if you want to have a certain feel to your writing, you can use longer sentences like Lovecraft, but it's just not as easy to fall in as a reader, I think, into that kind of into that long type of writing. So, all this to say, yeah, I think deleting the word that usually is a good rule of thumb. But I think it also sets up an interesting thing. We have a lot of top-down knowledge, right? As the person that's writing or the person that's speaking, we have a lot of top-down knowledge about what we're trying to say. If you're writing a report for school, you know where you're going with it. Well, hopefully you know where you're going with it. Although I've read a couple where, not in our class, our class is pretty good. We also don't have, you know, reports. So, cool. We're all good. But in other classes, I've read some reports that maybe they didn't have any idea where they were going when they started. And it just kind of seems like they're making it up as they go along, like a like some old dude kicking a can down the street, not sure where the can's going to go, so he just chases it. But usually, when you're writing something, you've got an idea of where you're taking it. When you go back and edit it, you definitely know what you're saying in the end. So you've got all this top-down knowledge, and you're going through and you're cutting out words like that, or which, or whom, or whatever. Your top-down knowledge, though, means that you know that the phrase, "the horse raced past the barn fell," makes sense to you because you've got the top-down knowledge. So you cut out the word "that." Well, you know what I mean. And then the person who comes in to read it later when you turn it in or give it to somebody to read what you've written is garden-pathed by that sentence. So I think it's important to, number one, be aware that, yeah, it is important to cut out the word "that" sometimes. It's extraneous, and you want, you know, and it doesn't matter what you're writing. If you're writing for school, if you're writing for fun, if you're writing for a job, a lot of you are going to have personal statements and stuff that you want to write. Yes, cut out "that's" that are not necessary, because you want the person reading to enjoy it. You want them to fall into it easily. You want them to be sucked in quickly, because that's going to get you a better grade. It's going to get you hired quicker, or they're just going to like your story better. But at the same time, you've got this other thing to balance, which is you need to be aware that they have no top-down knowledge like you do. So you can't cut out every "that" because you might top down them, you might garden path them. And then that would lead to them thinking that you were a confusing writer, when actually you might be perfectly fine. You're cutting out so many "that's" to try to be an even better writer, and they think that you're confusing. So it's important to balance those two pieces of information. All right, well, there's other ways that syntax might not be the king when it comes to decoding sentences. Some of those are what the book calls lexical preferences, and there's both verb and noun preferences. And this doesn't mean, like, our preference to use them. This actually means, like, the preference of the verb itself. What does the verb prefer? And what that means, I mean, that sounds totally crazy and like we're animating this word. But what it means is, what does the verb usually modify? That's what it means. So raced usually modifies directly an object. It is the thing that you're talking about that is doing the racing, right? The horse raced. Usually, the word "raced" is going to be the actual verb of what the horse is doing. So what is the horse doing? It raced. Or what was it doing, I should say. What was the horse doing? It raced. That verb is usually used that way. Sure, it can be used as a past participle, but not often. And you've got different classes of verbs that are going to have different preferences. One of the ways that I tend to think about which word is a, which verb is which? Is it a past participle? Is it just the regular tense of the verb? Is I put it with the noun, right? So if we think about a raced horse, if you can put it that way, that's the past participle version of raced. But horse raced, that's just the simple past tense version. So you've got past tense, you've got past participle. I know, it's crazy, especially if you haven't had English classes or you haven't had them in a long time. But a good way to think about it, like I said, is where does horse go in relation to raced? Where does whispered go in relation to secret, the whispered secret Well, that's a past participle, right? Secret whispered doesn't actually make sense, but you could have like someone whispered, she whispered, and that would just be the simple past tense version. So that's, yes, admittedly a hard concept, but if you think about it that way, like where does the noun go in relation to that verb? And that'll tell you when is the past participle. Noun first, regular past tense. Noun second, that is a past participle. It's kind of often used as an adjective in that case, really. So the horse raced past the barn. We are commenting on which horse, right? Like the whole point of it, like we talked about earlier, is disambiguating that horse from the other horses that weren't raced past the barn. So it's not the only way that past participles can be used, but that is a way that they can be used. And a lot of garden path sentences use this type of past participle. Not all of them, but it's a more confusing form. Anyway, the verb preference. So we have a lot of verbs that like to be used as regular, simple, past tense verbs. And then we also have some verbs that like to be used as past participles. Depending on the way that we usually use that verb in the English language, that dictates the way that you're going to think about the sentence that you're reading. Think about it like probability, right? Or the deforming the attractor landscape. So whichever way you typically use that word, you come in contact with raced, and all of a sudden, your landscape is deformed downward. Your marble starts running towards that horse was racing, right? That's where your marble goes, because that is usually the way that that verb is used. If you want to think about it as probabilities, it's a very high probability that's being used as a simple past tense verb, because that's the way that it's usually used. And then there are instances when verbs are used the other way. So we kind of have this knowledge in our brains because of what we've seen in the past. We've seen words used different ways in the past, and then we will apply that knowledge to the sentence that we're reading. And that isn't a syntactic structure. There are also noun preferences. And it kind of depends on whether the noun is animate or inanimate. But if you say horse raced, to use, you know, the same example that we were using, yeah, that horse can race past something. And so that is likely that you're using this, that it's going to come out as it's the object of the sentence. So that noun is going to be the object of the sentence. But if we say letter raced, the letter raced past the barn was dropped. Well, letters can't race, right? They have no legs or wings. They have no method of propulsion whatsoever. Stupid letters. So a letter would have to be taken past a barn somehow. It could be raced past a barn by someone on a horse, like the Pony Express, right? So then the letter is raced past the barn, and then it was dropped. And so depending on the type of noun that you're looking at, that sets up, again, a probability, or it deforms the attractor landscape to prepare you to understand the sentence that's coming. You know it's an inanimate object, so it's not going to be doing anything. It is not the object of the sentence. Not the active object of the sentence, I should say. So there are a couple different models that make use of this information. We know, right, there aren't many researchers that would discount all of this different information. Verb and noun preferences, and plausibility effects. Not a lot of people are going to argue against that and say, no, no, it's syntax, it's all syntax. But there are different thoughts on how likely it is that all of this is used. Which one takes preference, I should say. So you've got a weak interactive model. And essentially what that says is, well, hey, you know, these are cool. Plausibility, lexical preferences, it's all cool. But syntax is still king. Syntax and syntactical structure is where it's at. When that breaks down, when there's a garden path sentence or what have you, then these other effects will come in and save the day. But usually, the person who's usually the hero of the story is syntactical structure. That's the weak interactive model. You've also got a strong interactive model. This is sometimes called the constraint-based model. And this is kind of a teamwork model where you've got syntactical structure, you've got plausibility, you've got verb preferences and noun preferences, and they're all working together and deforming the attractor landscape or setting up a tree of probabilities and arriving at one conclusion for the sentence that you're reading or listening to. That, again, is the constraint-based model. Teamwork. So, remember when we talked about serial and parallel processing? Think about it really quickly. What is serial processing? You can shout it out, especially if you're at the gym with your headphones in. Just shout it out. No one will think you're weird. What is serial processing? That's right. Person who's in the gym and just shouted at the guy lifting weights in front of them. Serial processing means one thing happens at a time. It's a chain of events, right? Think about water flowing down a chain. Water flows down a chain. Quick aside. Do you know about these like water flowing chains? They are super cool. Instead of gutters, what some people use, like really fancy houses use, are they'll just get these decorative chains, and because water likes to attach to objects because of hydrogen bonding, it'll just flow down these chains. You don't really need a gutter. You need a gutter if you're trying to direct water away from an area. So if you're directing it very far, you know, off of your lawn, you want it to go into your driveway instead of your lawn, sure, you need a gutter. But what you can do is, instead of the downspout on your gutter, you can install this chain, and it looks really nice. It looks way nicer than just your typical downspout gutter thing. So you have a gutter to trap the water. The water goes over, reaches this chain, and then the water will flow down the chain. And it looks really, they're totally cool. You can put like plants on them and stuff. Anyway, it's super awesome. The point here is that water flows down a chain. And serial processing is going to be like water flowing down that chain. It hits one link, and then it keeps flowing. It gets to the next link. It keeps flowing, gets to the next link. A serial processing model would say that it would go, let's say, syntax, and then plausibility, and then verb preferences. A parallel processing model means that all these things are happening in parallel. So different lines, you can think of like on a piece of paper, you've got all these parallel lines. Each one of those is a different kind of processing. So syntactic processing, lexical preferences, plausibility effects, they're all working at the same time. And they're generating their own probability trees. They're deforming these different landscapes. And while working at the same time, they're also working together. So if they all arrive at the same conclusion, if they all generate the same attractor well, that's where the marble goes. If they don't generate the same attractor wells, the marble is going to kind of, it's going to go to one or the other. And it's going to go to the one that's likely the one that's deeper. So they might not arrive at the same conclusion. But if two of the three arrive at the same conclusion, the marble goes there. If all of them arrive at different conclusions, it could be a random choice where the marble falls. So that's the difference between a serial and parallel processing model. The constraint-based model, just based on the way that it's structured, would be a parallel processing model. not a serial processing model. A serial processing model would say that something is higher up on the food chain, right? There is a hierarchy to it. And that's not the case in the constraint-based model. There's also something called an unrestricted race model. And this is essentially, it's chaos. It starts out sort of the same way as the constraint-based model, where everything is working in parallel. And they're all deforming their own attractors. But here's, well, I should say they're all deforming the attractor space. But the distinction is, they're not deforming the same landscape. Constraint-based, they're working together to deform the same landscape and come together to make a more probable area where the marble will fall. Unrestricted race model would say that there are three different landscapes that don't interact with each other. So there's no way that they can work together to deform the landscape. And there's no multiple nodes in the landscape for a marble to fall into. Instead, what happens is they're all deforming different landscapes, and the one that deforms quickest that a marble can fall into, that's the one that takes the cake. So, if you're reading a sentence and the syntactic structure deforms the landscape enough to where that's the most likely interpretation of the sentence for syntactic structure, and it does it before the others have finished processing the sentence, you go with the syntactic meaning of the sentence. Maybe the meaning would have been different if you relied on verb preferences, but because that didn't happen as fast, that's not the one that your perception is going to go with. So that's the unrestricted race model. It is literally a race, right? That's why it's called the race model. And then there's also the good enough processing model, which essentially, you know, just kind of says like, you know, we're not trying to be perfect. Anything that is talking about how we can process all these sentences perfectly is ridiculous. An unrestricted race model that's going to help us do it perfectly every time, bogus. A constraint-based model that helps us predict this perfectly every time, bogus. Syntactic structure gets it close every time, no. Good enough means they're all kind of working, but none of them are right all the time. So all these different features are important. So lexical preferences are important, syntactic structure is important, but none of them are going to be right all the time. And we're not processing things in a way that we're trying to get to the most likely thing all the time. You think about it, the good enough model lends itself really well to an attractor landscape kind of view. So if you're thinking about the attractor landscape as deforming, like let's say a bed, think about your bed at home, your mattress. If you have something round sitting on it, it's like a golf ball, and you poke down in the middle, the golf ball is going to roll towards your finger no matter where it was. That's kind of the good enough model. Like, something deforms the landscape a little bit, and the marble is going to go. Now, I know sometimes, especially with the images that I showed you about the attractor landscape model a while ago, the attractor landscape is flat, and then there's a well that, you know, is deformed inside of there. And that would be more like your other typical models. It takes a little bit more work and a little deeper of an attractor to actually make the marble fall in. And so the good enough hypothesis would say it's just really easy for the marble to fall wherever there's a deformation of the landscape. It's good enough, literally, you know, just like it sounds, it's good enough. One of the things that we see happening here with the good enough model, this is from the Warren text, is that when people are shown the sentence, while Anna dressed the baby, played in the crib, when you ask people, did Anna dress the baby? They'll say yes. But did the baby play in the crib? Then they will say yes, also yes. And so somehow, this ambiguous sentence, while Anna dressed, the baby played in the crib, you stop it while Anna dressed the baby, yeah, it sounds like Anna's dressing the baby. If you say the whole sentence and you think about it, it sounds like Anna was dressing herself, and while she was doing that, the baby played in the crib, so the baby did not get dressed, it just played in the crib. But because we're kind of like processing these things all at once, and you could make a case that this actually supports a number of different models, but the good enough model is usually what this kind of phenomenon supports. It says that we're processing it in a few multiple different ways. We're kind of processing it shallowly, because usually we don't see one sentence in isolation. There's usually some other information. So we see this one sentence, and we have these ideas of what the sentence could mean that are held in our memory. We have a mental model of these sentences, and maybe more information will show up for us to modify the picture that we have. One of these ideas that we have will just kind of poof away, and the other one will stick around. That really does support the good enough model. But it's important to note that we don't know which one is correct. There has to be a lot more research done with these models, with different ways that people read, with different ways that people write, with different ways that people listen, to figure out which one is most likely. There's evidence that supports each one, but that's what's kind of cool about, I think I've totally said this before, but what's totally cool about science is you're learning about this, and we don't have the answer to how sentences are processed yet. We have some ideas. We have some theories. We know some facts. Those facts are informing our theories, but we're not sure about which theory is correct. It's entirely possible that me or you or somebody you know, somebody we know, you know, at the speech and hearing department or in the language and literature building at ASU could solve this problem. Any one of us could. It's there to be solved. And now you know the main components of the argument, so maybe you can come up with an experiment and try to figure it out. So I just talked about mental model. What is a mental model? A mental model is essentially, there's probably a better textbook definition, but the way that I think about mental model is just a picture of what's happening. So when people say, you know, that that garbage about, well, when I read, it's like I'm seeing a movie in my mind. That's, you know, that's the mental model that I think of. So you're reading things, but you're picturing it too. Now I will give you a reason why I think this is true. And I think this is because humans are fundamentally spatial creatures. I've absolutely talked about this in this class, I think. But humans are fundamentally spatial. Everything that we do revolves around space, right? I mean, eating, we need to know where the food is. Running away from danger, we need to know where the danger is and where the safe place is. Fighting, where's the bad guy? Finding a mate, where is the mate? What do they look like? All these kinds of things. Like, it's all about where things are. Hearing is a lot of information about space. Vision is a lot of information about space. Even olfactory senses are a lot of information about space. Where is the stinky thing? Where is the thing that smells good? The only one that I can't really make a case for is taste. That's the only sense that we have that isn't at least somewhat or mostly related to spatial navigation or spatial thought. But But I guess without taste, you know, then we wouldn't know ice cream was good. So I'm glad we have it. But it doesn't really, again, relate to, like, space. So anyway, language and reading generates this mental model, this picture of, like, space. Like, we come up with, like, this fictional space somewhere in our minds and kind of represent what's going on. So one of the really interesting byproducts of this is that we don't have good memories for accurate sentences. We have really good memories for the gists of sentences. In the book, this is exemplified by the use of the three sentences, right, about the turtles. So the sentence about the turtles are, there's three turtles sitting on a log, a fish swims under the log. There's a whole bunch of other sentences that people read, and then later, people are given the sentence, a fish swam under the turtles. And they're asked, is this true? Did you read the sentence? And people will say, oh yeah, I read that sentence. I remember a fish swimming under the turtles. However, if we change one word in that first sentence from three turtles were sitting on a log to three turtles were sitting near a log, they don't think that a fish swam under the turtles anymore. So three turtles were sitting near a log, a fish swam under the log. Do you remember reading a sentence about a fish swimming under the turtles? Well, no. The fish swam under the log. So what's going on here? Why is it that you change one word and people will not remember seeing this fake sentence? But if you didn't change the word, they do think they saw the or heard or read the fake sentence. Well, it seems to be because they're generating a mental picture, this movie in their mind, about what's going on. So they imagine three turtles sitting on a log. They get this one image of three turtles sitting on a log. Then they read that a fish swims under the log. The turtles are still there. The fish swims under the log. So this is the image that they have. Later, they're asked, did you read a sentence about the fish swimming under the turtles? And, you know, they don't know, really. They can't, it seems like they can't pull direct word-by-word information out of their brain to see if they did see that sentence. But what they can access is this mental model, this picture of what they saw. And this sentence is consistent with that mental model. If the fish swims under the log, the fish swims under the turtles. We're good. So yes, I did see a sentence that said the fish swam under the turtles. But when the turtles are sitting near the log, where are they sitting? Presumably on the bank, or they're sitting on a rock or something, and a fish swims under a log. It didn't swim under the turtles. So they know it's not consistent with their mental model. There's another effect with this as well. People were given a series of instructions. One of the instructions said, mark carefully the answers you got wrong and do nothing to your correct answers. Then, at the end of whatever test they were actually given, which was not the important part of the experiment, they were shown instructions again, and they were asked, were these the instructions you saw? One of those said, carefully mark the answers you got wrong and do nothing to your correct answers, or do nothing to your correct answers, yeah. So in this case, the difference was they switched around carefully and mark. Mark carefully your incorrect answers, or carefully mark your incorrect answers. And people said, yeah, I saw that. So they don't actually know the order of the words that they saw, carefully mark or mark carefully, because the meaning is the same. It doesn't really matter what order they were in. They know that that was what was meant. But if they were given the phrase, or rather the sentence, carefully mark your incorrect answers and do nothing to correct your answer, your the ones you got, and do nothing to correct your answers. Yeah, sorry. So here, what they're changing is, instead of your correct, they change it to correct your. So do nothing to your correct answers is very different than do nothing to correct your answers, right? It's a totally different meaning. You've still just changed the order of two words. That's it. But almost every participant. I don't know what's going on with the people that don't recognize this is different, but almost every participant recognizes that this is not what they saw. So they have an idea that, okay, I'm marking my incorrect answers. I'm not supposed to do anything to my other ones. Or they have the idea, okay, I'm marking my other ones and they don't want me to change these. These two mental models that they have of what's happening or what they're supposed to do are very different. And so they know that's not what I read. But when the mental model is consistent with the sentence, then they don't really know. This makes me think of the testimony that's going on with the impeachment hearings right now. A lot of it is based on, what did you hear, right? Or what did you read? And one of the things that I have to wonder is, like, well, how good are we at knowing? How good are these people at remembering what they heard or what they read? And these experiments would say that, you know, if they were testifying that they heard exactly word for word, blah, 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 I don't think I would put a lot of weight to that testimony. I think they would be mistaken. Because they've constructed a mental model, and word for word might not be the same as what their mental model is. But credit to the people that are testifying and being truthful, you know, to themselves, that they're not saying that I heard exactly these words in exactly this way. A lot of them are saying, I don't remember exactly what was said, but the gist of it was this. And that I would believe. Because that is consistent with the research that we see, that we can remember the gist of things. We know what's meant. We have a mental model, and we can judge whether our mental model is consistent with something else. Or we have a mental model, and we can say what the mental model is. But then if somebody asks us, well, is this exactly word for word, 100% exactly like this, what it was, we can't really know. Well, here's one other thing. These ideas of mental models and gists remind me of what we just talked about, of the good enough model. And are we really just processing sentences that we hear and read in a way that's good enough to get us an accurate mental model? To me, it seems that it's very likely that that's true. It's really difficult. I don't know if you've tried this, but I can't type without looking at my fingers. So if I'm trying to type something exactly, like if I'm quoting something or if I'm typing in, you know, something exactly, whatever, I will read what is on the paper and then I'll go type it. And then I'll have to go back and check to make sure that what I just typed is what was actually on the paper that I'm reading. Because it's very likely that if I read one or two sentences, I will just start putting them into my own words, and it's not an exact quote then. People who are really good at this type without looking at their fingers, right? Like receptionists and stenographers and all sorts of people like that, they will type. They don't have to look at their fingers. They can just keep their eyes on what they're copying from, and then they don't run into this problem. It's really difficult to process words and language exactly, but it's not hard at all to to come up with a mental model of what you just read and then rewrite it. So it seems like possibly the good enough model could be correct. And that really what we're doing is we're processing sentences and we're processing them decently, but only good enough to make a mental model that makes sense, that we can tell that is consistent with something else. Garden path sentences are tricky because we're not able to process them even good enough. They're weird and they defy our the ways that we process things. So we're not able to even make a coherent mental model out of these sentences because they're confusing. So it's a possibility that that could be the truth. It's a possibility that they all could be, but linking these two ideas together seems to go hand in hand to me. If you think about the "and address the baby" idea, there's our mental model. We've come up with a mental model here. We've generated a mental model for Anne addressing the baby. We've generated a mental model for the baby playing in the crib. And then, like I said, we're waiting for some other information to nix one of these mental models. Without that, we keep them both. So I'll switch gears and talk about antecedents and anaphoras. This is the last thing that I'll talk about in this in our audio lecture for this week. But it's got another, well, I've got another writing thing that I want to talk about in there too. But first, I guess we should talk about like what the heck these are, right? So an antecedent, you can think about it as like your proper noun. So if you're writing a story and you want to say like the hero is Francis. Francis is the hero of the story. That's your antecedent, your proper noun. So Francis walks into a room. She sits down on a chair. She orders a beer. She leaves. The end. So again, the antecedent is Francis. It's a proper noun. The anaphora is the instance of she, this pronoun that you're using to refer back to the proper noun. That's the anaphora. Or I should say that's the anaphor. Anaphora is the pluralized form. But anyway, so the anaphor, she orders a beer. She is the anaphor of Francis. There's different types of antecedents than anaphors. One of the interesting phenomena that come out of this is the difference between a specific and a categorical antecedent or anaphor. So a categorical anaphor, let's say, okay, so let's stick with Frances in this story. And let's say that she's a private detective or whatever, right? So there's a person who is a former soldier that is some guy. He's a former soldier. She needs to question him. He does not want to be questioned. So he's the antagonist at this point. And if we started with a categorical description of the person, a man was sitting at the bar, and then we switched to a specific description. So our anaphor was a very specific. And then we said, the soldier. It would be confusing because you're going from very large, very broad categorical descriptor, and then for your antecedent, and then for your anaphor, you're going very specific. So you've generated this broad category, man. Man could be anything, right? I mean, a man can do any job. He could be described in a number of ways. You could call him Beardy. You know, like you could say a man was sitting at the bar. Beardy jumped up and ran away. And that would still be a categorical descriptor and then a specific descriptor. And it's confusing. You're trying to figure out like, well, is Beardy, does that relate to this really general descriptor? Now, if you go the other way, if you go a specific descriptor as your antecedent to a categorical descriptor as your anaphor, that's okay. Now, one of the possibilities here is that the specific descriptor gives us a lot of information about whatever it is. So if we say a soldier, that doesn't necessarily imply man, but it implies person. And so then you can say the man got up and ran away. We would then infer that the man was the soldier that was in question. You could say this beardy guy as your specific antecedent, and then man as your anaphor, and that makes total sense. You've already said with your antecedent, it is a bearded guy. And so then when you say man, that makes sense. We can link it to the information that's there. But when you give a categorical descriptor and then you give something very specific, it's hard to link that specific information to the category because the category is so broad. When you see this breakdown, when you see that a categorical descriptor actually does work for a specific anaphor later, is when you say that the antecedent is doing something that's very specific to the later anaphor. So, like a man was dressed all in camouflage and he didn't have a beard, he was like clean cut. Then you say the soldier. Well, then we've got enough information about that categorical antecedent that it's not hard for us to make the link to the specific anaphor later. And that's when it breaks down. In the book, they use a fish attacked, and then they say shark. And it's much more easy for you to go from a fish attacking, because you're presumably, the person who's reading this is thinking like, oh, a fish attacked someone, that it's like a shark, it's like a vicious fish, right? And so then you say the shark swam away. Okay, the shark is the anaphor, and that makes sense with what I've already figured out about this antecedent. It's a vicious fish that can attack, so the shark works. But just saying the fish was here, the shark was not here, then it's hard to link shark to fish when you're not talking about it doing something specific to its specific category that you're going to introduce later. The idea of explicit and implicit antecedents and anaphors is really similar, actually, I think. So if you think about, we're talking about, I got the medical supplies out of the closet. Medical supplies is the antecedent. So I would say something like, I got the medical supplies out of the closet. I cracked open the smelling salts. Well, smelling salts technically are medical supplies. They're not like the first type of medical supplies that you might think of. So if I'm saying I got medical supplies out of the closet, you might think bandage. You might think, aspirin. Some sort of pain, a different kind of painkiller, maybe some tweezers, a knife, a scalpel, you know, whatever. Disinfectant. But the first thing that comes to your mind is definitely not smelling salts. So we have this very explicit anaphor of smelling salts. And that would take longer to process than if I said, I got the smelling salts out of the closet. I broke open the smelling salts. That's an implicit anaphor. It's like so implicit I'm saying it twice. I got the smelling salts out of the closet. Okay, smelling salts are the antecedent. I broke open the smelling salts. Smelling salts is the anaphor. Cool. It's the same thing. Very implicit. You could also say I got the smelling salts out of the closet, I broke the salts open. And then you're kind of changing the anaphor a little bit, but it's still implicit. But then again, explicit takes a lot longer to process because people who are reading it would have to think like, oh geez, where did these smelling salts come from? Oh yeah, okay, I guess that they're considering that medical supplies. There's the same idea with the picnic supplies and the beer in the book. The beer was warm. Is that a picnic supply? So if you haven't read it yet, the picnic supplies is the antecedent and beer is the anaphore. And the picnic supplies came out of the trunk. The beer was warm. Where did this freaking beer come from, you think, as the reader? Oh, I guess that must be picnic supplies. All right. So it takes longer to process. You're kind of thrown for a loop for a second. Here's another writing thing I want to talk about really quickly. And the writing thing is how often you should link up your pronoun with all, or no, sorry, how often you should link up your proper noun with all the pronouns you use. So when I was in college, I always heard the rule of thumb of like three lines. If you go more than three lines without referring to your main character, without referring to any character that you're talking about by name, that's too long. Your reader is going to forget what you're talking about. So you should say the name of the main character again. Or, to put it in terms of psycholinguistics, you should use the antecedent again. You can do antecedent, anaphore, 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 but eventually you should use antecedent again. Now, sure, there's other things that come into play here. I mean, like, how many other characters do you have? You certainly need to use different antecedents when you've got multiple characters. But let's just assume we're talking about a single character. Use one antecedent and then tons of anaphores. And again, the rule of thumb when I was in college was three lines. Then you need to start using the antecedent again, or once, and then you can switch back to anaphores. But I was looking around to try to find a reference for this that I could put up on Canvas, and I can't find anybody talking about the three-line rule anymore. It seems like, you know, I mean, I didn't go to college that long ago. Certainly websites from that time are still up. Now it seems like it's much more loose, and the rule of thumb is like, well, hey, anytime you talk about a new character, you need to say the name, which I totally agree with. I don't think that's wrong. It'd be very confusing if you didn't. But that rule doesn't seem to exist. I will say that thinking about it from a psycholinguistics perspective, you have to be aware of working memory and taxing somebody's working memory. So, yeah, if you have one object or character, it doesn't matter. You could be writing something scientific, academic. You could be talking about anaphores, and then you could just refer to it as them, or they, or whatever. And that works. I mean, you can't use antecedent all the time. You don't want to use this proper noun every time you refer to an anaphore. You don't want to just say anaphore, 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 anaphore. It would get repetitive and kind of annoying. So you want to use pronouns. You want to use anaphores. Kind of ironic. But you have to keep in mind that, yeah, even though there is only one object that you might be talking about, it will start to cover a lot of information without referring back to anaphore. Even somebody with pretty high working memory might start to get a little confused if they haven't heard that proper noun come up again. So, three lines, I don't know about three lines. There's not a lot of scientific evidence that says the three-line rule works. Actually, there's no scientific evidence that says the three-line rule works. But I'm not even seeing the three-line rule come up again, like I said, in typical just writing style websites. But in your own writing, it would be good to be mindful of using a good balance of antecedents and anaphores. So you want to introduce what it actually is. Again, if you're writing about anaphores, you'd want to say anaphores, and then you'd want to say them a few times, or they, and then switch back to using anaphores to try to offset the tax to working memory. As for three lines, who knows? That actually might be something that I want to try to do research on soon. But, you know, to see what the best use of switching back to your antecedent is. What's the sweet spot between being annoying and taxing working memory? There's got to be a sweet spot. But what I want you to do this week, this is your assignment for the week, and I'll post the assignment on Canvas. You can take a look at all the ins and outs again if you need to. What I want you to do is I want you to look at two different books. I want you to grab a fun novel that you've got sitting somewhere in your house or on your Kindle, whatever. And I want you to grab a textbook. You can use our textbook or you can use any other textbook. I would prefer that you use a different textbook, but if you don't have another textbook sitting around, ours is fine. What you're going to do is, for 30 instances of antecedents in each book, I want you to count how many anaphors are used before switching back to the antecedent. So, what that means is, if you see, like, let's say they're talking about sweatshirts. Yes, I'm in my closet. If they're talking about sweatshirts, then you're going to start counting. So you'll write down, maybe in an Excel spreadsheet is probably the best way to do this. Write down sweatshirts. That's the antecedent. And then you're just going to count how many anaphors are used until another antecedent comes up. So sweatshirts are really nice. They are comfortable. There's one anaphor. They are cheap. There's two anaphors. But they can pick up dog hair. There's three anaphors. Leather jackets. There's your other antecedent. So you'd write down leather jackets are good because they look really cool. So there's they. That's another anaphor. But they are costly. And there's two. So your spreadsheet would have sweatshirts, three, leather jackets, two. And you just count up how many anaphors for every antecedent are used. What I'm curious about is there a difference between academic textbook writing and novel writing in how many anaphors are used per antecedent? I will collect your data when you turn it in, and I will get it back to you so we can all take a look at it and talk about it, hopefully, in the next... Well, that's not going to work because I'm going to put up... There might be a bonus lecture that is not tested on in any way for the class. And there will be. I'll do it for you no matter... Even if it's only five of you that are interested, I'll put it up. Anyway... I'll put up a bonus lecture where we talk about the data that we've collected, and what it looks like in the class and what it means. Listen to it if you want. If you just want to be done with the class, you don't have to listen to it. It's totally fine. I won't test you on it at all. But if you're curious, it'll be there for you. Anyway, the other thing I want to tell you really quickly is I'm going to work absolutely my hardest to get next week's stuff up on Sunday or Monday. I really want to go for Sunday, but it could be Monday. So just a couple days from when this drops is when you'll have your next week's assignments and lectures open. And the reason for that is it's Thanksgiving. So I want you to be able to, while you're traveling or while you have some time, be able to work on this stuff and not have it interact with your fun time. So definitely want you to be able to have fun with everybody. Do your conversational breaking norms assignment if you want to over Thanksgiving. It might be fun and hilarious to pick on one of your cousins that you only sort of like. or whatever, you know, just it'll be there for you. The due date would be the same, like in December, as it would be if I posted it on Thanksgiving or the day before Thanksgiving. But I want to get it out early so you can have time to work on it. Okay. All right. I will talk to you soon.
Soon. Soon. Soon. Shalom.